Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Dota from Occident Invicta. Dota, it's great having you back on.
Thank you very much for inviting me back.
So we're going to be discussing your articles you've written on the topics of oligarchy and on national capitalism. The first one I'd like to discuss is the one Oligarchy 101. This is about this BBC report that five banks, JP Morgan, Citigroup, and a number of other ones have rigged the foreign exchange market.
Right. Well, basically what they were doing is, from what I recall, members from these banks basically met up in a chat room and decided to rig the market by entering in a position earlier on during the day, during the session, and then exiting that position just before the session would end. And they would obviously buy up a huge, you know, they buy up a huge volume of currency, thereby, you know, making the market go in their direction. And then they pretty much dump it at the end of the session. That's my understanding of what they were up to. And it seemed to have worked. They fooled a lot of people, and they've been doing this since, I believe, the late 2000s, like 2008 and on. It's remarkable they never got caught.
Well, they got a fine, but the point you're making that it's basically like a slap on the wrist.
Oh yes, because of course these people, well, of course they're banks. I mean, to them, a fine, you know, a fine like that is a mere slap on the wrist. It really is. And of course, it's not just it's basically regular ordinary traders that lose, you know. And I mean, this reminds me of a similar scandal, I think, in the 1970s, where a couple of businessmen, billionaires in the U.S., tried to rig the silver market. I cannot remember the fellow's name, but this is something he tried to do in the 70s by just buying up a lot of silver and artificially driving the price up. And then obviously others get into it as well. And then they, as the price is artificially inflated, they simply dump the goods at that artificially inflated price, raking in huge profits. I guess that was the idea here as well. So what these guys are doing is we're getting together and they're cooperating, you know, and that's ironic because these banks are supposed to be competitors. You know, and but that was not the case. So basically oligarchy in action. They got together, decided where the market was going to go, decided recently sort of shoring up the price of the currency, and then before the session would end, they'd dump it. Now, a lot of day traders, ordinary day traders, would be ruined in this way, you know. So it was pretty shameful, in my view. And it makes a mockery of capitalism in general.
Yeah, it is a monopoly because if they're not competing with each other, then they're the same bank.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're more of an oligarchy, actually. You know, you have a bunch of people, you have a bunch of these huge organizations, companies, or whatever, and what they're really doing is that they're cooperating with one another. I mean, on the surface, it seems like they're competing with one another, but in reality, they're actually cooperating with one another, and really, this shouldn't come as a surprise, you know, and what I found particularly appalling was that these were banks in the U.S. and in the U.K., so it's not that they're just a bunch of American banks that are sort of getting together here and, you know, plotting, but it's there's a certain international component to this. You had British banks as well in it as well, so it was really quite the scandal. I mean, this story kind of hit close to home because I was demo trading Forex, you know, in 2008 and 2009. I never really did put any actual money into the Forex market, but I did demo trade the market from time to time using various platforms like IBFX and such. Well, I don't think the company is even in operation anymore. But so to me, you know, this was, this story hit close to home because I was quite interested in the Forex market. Still am to some extent. I do check on the market from time to time, you know, and I have known people that have lost a lot of money in Forex, you know, friends of the family and such. So it's really quite shameful because what they're really doing is they're ruining a lot of traders who do this, some of them who do this for a living, and then some of them who simply, you know, use this as a financial instrument, you know, just something to build up their savings. That's just another instrument in their portfolio, you know, regular people getting screwed this way. So it really is a very shameful incident here.
The point you make is that it's not a free market. Do you get? I guess a lot of people who are apologists for this will defend. They'll defend and say it's just part of the free market, and there should be no regulations on financial transactions.
Well, yes, see, that's sort of the problem here. We're looking at this, what capitalism has really become now is basically a capitalism essentially becomes leads to oligarchies, because there's some individuals in the economy that obviously have access to more resources than others. And it's if there's no government regulation, at some point they will form these oligarchies and they will cooperate rather than compete. And it's just a very natural thing, I mean, it just makes sense. And then, of course, they'll do so with the cooperation of the state. It's all like mercantilism in the 17th century, where you had these merchants, merchant class getting into business with the state. And it's a very similar idea here. You have certain powerful corporate elites, they're in bed with the state, essentially, that gives them cover to continue doing what they're doing. This is not really the capitalism that Adam Smith had in mind, though. Smith's idea of capitalism was very different, and that's also because Smith was living in a time that was before, the era of mass production and mass
So he
consumption. To
envisioned a
him,
bunch of small businesses competing against each other.
he basically believed that if you have, I mean, you have an area, like a neighborhood or a town or something, and then you had local businesses taking care of their communities. And that's all it was, as far as he was concerned, because you're looking at a time when feudalism was obviously on the decline, and so resources were now in the hands of the private sector, or what would eventually become the private sector, in the hands of private individuals, to do as they pleased. Which is why I've often said that Adam Smith's capitalism was basically just an economic extension of Lockean liberalism. That was basically the same idea. It was just an economic extension of John Locke. You have, people have the right, to determine their own livelihood, and that gives them a certain measure of self-sufficiency and determination. That's the idea. Now, Smith obviously did not really see an era where, certain corporations would then make a grab for, major resources in the economy. That never really occurred to him, because obviously he had not seen mass production, which would also in time make, the average worker indispensable. I mean, sorry, dispensable. Quite the opposite.
It's basically what capitalism has led to. Do you see this as an inevitable result of capitalism?
See, it's hard to say. Like I said, what we're looking at right now is mass production, the era of mass production, and capitalism with mass production is, in my view, a pretty toxic combination, and of course, now Smith obviously did not really realize, and he could not foresee the various technological innovations that would come in manufacturing, right? And so this was something that he did not know, I would assume. And so with mass production, you've got mass production is what shaped capitalism, and the way people has it's just shaped what we see as, what we know as the common perception of capitalism. This has led to many various other issues, because as production became more efficient, the only way capitalism could keep going to sustain itself would be to continue to, increase output. And of course, if output is increased, then there has to be, a market to consume that output. So the domestic market is not big enough, then the only option is to export. And that's where colonialism then basically came about. Because the idea behind colonialism is to basically capture foreign markets mostly, not really rule over them in the same way as, the Romans or the Ottomans ruled over their territories. Not really. The idea, what made European colonialism so different from some of the older brands of colonialism, like say, Islamic colonialism or whatever, is that in this case, the colonies were treated as markets and they were kept at arm's length. These are not like the Romans or the Abbasids or some of these other empires throughout history that we're trying to, create this major, unit, like a major empire of sorts. I mean, it was an empire in a manner of speaking, But the idea was to capture markets, because without those markets, their economies would implode. There'd be a lot of production, but there would be no consumption. So at some point, production would have to be scaled back, which would, result in people losing their jobs and then the economy basically just imploding. So that's what's become of capitalism. It's much of it has to do with basically mass production and, of course, mass consumption as well.
Bay Area guy has this article, and he points out that Glenn Greenwald wrote an article about how the elites embrace a lot of these so-called social justice causes. They mean promoting their own power and sanitizing their crimes. Did you write on that, or did you write about that Glenn Greenwald article?
I read his article, yes. It's worthwhile point. I think what Bay Area guy was actually saying, and he's actually quite right when he points out that traditionally the left was more focused on economic justice and economic equality, but somehow because of recent trends, and of course by recent I mean mostly post-World War trends, the left essentially became somewhat saturated with Marxism, cultural Marxism. So in this case, of course, the focus shifted away from economic justice to social justice. But of course, I don't really see this as social justice. This is in some ways a parody of social justice. So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way of actually accomplishing a very interesting goal, and that is to obviously divert attention away from economic issues and create a society that is in some ways at war with one another. I mean, I don't really subscribe to Marxism and to, the Marxist theory of class struggle. I think it's a very two-dimensional way of looking at history. There's a lot more to history, and there's a lot more to history than simply looking at it through the lens of class struggle. So, but in this case, but if I were to actually sort of, parody Marxism, I would say that what they've really done is that they've, with their emphasis on social justice and, the freak show of the cultural left, as Robert Lindsay likes to say, call it. What they've really done is they've sort of restructured a vertical class war into a horizontal class war. And I think that was what, and I think that was the gist of what Beria guy was getting at, because what he was trying to point out is that there's no real focus on economics anymore. And economic justice is, in my view, more leads to egalitarianism and leads to, long-term social stability.
If you look at the left now, originally it was about class. They talk about stuff like race, gender, sexual orientation. Except for, I guess Bernie Sanders is talking a lot about the class issues, but he's someone he's not part of the establishment. He's someone who's sort of part of the 60s era left. What is your take?
Right.
What is your sort of take on Bernie Sanders?
To be honest, I don't really don't know a whole lot about him, but I do understand where he's coming from, because as I pointed out, the old left was more concerned with economic justice. And in some ways that makes more sense. See, in my view, that is egalitarianism in the truest sense. Because when you create economic prosperity, you're creating it for everybody, regardless of who they are, where they come from, or what their sexual orientation is, and so on and so forth. There's no identity politics. When the economy is strong and per capita incomes are increasing, it benefits all citizens. And that's basically the idea. But that is essentially not really what our elites want. So their focus
What
now,
the
of course, is on.
modern left does is they will support the agenda of the corporations and the plutocracy in exchange for more affirmative action for women and minorities. That's basically what they're all about.
I would say so, yes. This sort of thing definitely benefits them, especially with, say, the rise of feminism in the 60s and onwards. It's created a market, not only a market, but it has essentially broadened the tax base. Women have entered the workforce, so wages have plummeted. So a lot of these social justice causes invariably end up serving, the interests of the elites. And there's also something to be said for a lot of the so-called philanthropy that's, that these elites are engaged in, like Bill Gates and, Warren Buffett and such. And what they're into is, when they donate to these charitable causes, what they're really doing is donating to causes such as feminism and such. I mean, I believe Warren was into had supported an initiative, an abortion on demand fund drive or something to that effect, a while
It's
ago.
also a
And
great way for them to get a tax write-off.
Oh yeah, undoubtedly. So they pursue their own agenda and they get a tax write-off as well because they can simply show this as, show these activities as charitable endeavors. Yeah, and of course Bill Gates and, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have been quite active in supporting, leftist causes. And I mean, recently I'd read, well, not recently, as in I think last year, I read about some initiatives in Africa, basically helping African farmers, women farmers specifically. We're not looking at farmers, but specifically women farmers. So the money goes specifically there. And so they do have their
I
own
know
ways.
Whole Foods. I think Whole Foods was involved in something like that with the donation. Is that the one you're talking about?
Interesting. Not aware of it, but I wouldn't be surprised. But yes, a lot of
Oh,
these charitable
that was not
foundations.
Africa. Whole Foods was doing something for. Oh, it was for helping women start up businesses in your home country, India.
Oh yeah, and this is how they basically export feminism to the third world. Because by specifically channeling resources to women, what they're trying to do, what they're trying to hammer home here, the point they're trying to hammer, especially in third world countries, is that women are also a class in the Marxist sense of the word, as a class in opposition to men, whose interests are in opposition to men. Because in the third world, and well, I shouldn't really say in the third world, but in basically in the non-Western world, whether it's developed or not, or otherwise, women have a different attitude, right? I mean, they believe that when they look at men, they see their uncles, their brothers, their fathers, and so on. But in the West, it's different. Women see men as, at best, competitors, or at worst, predators. They're a class in a Marxist sense of the word, a class in opposition to women. That's how men are seen in the West. And so by pursuing these activities in the third world, they're trying to drive home the same point that, women in the third world are also, a class, a distinct class, and a class in opposition to men with interests that run contrary to the interests of men. And it's, yeah, I mean, this is something they've been doing for a while, though. I mean, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, even the Rockefellers, for example, they're also into have also been pursuing these activities. I mean, when I was going through various homepages on various the homepages of various women's studies departments throughout certain, U.S. universities, such as the University of Rochester and the University of Hawaii. If you go, I mean, to name just a couple, I mean, off the top of my head, and they quite openly discuss taking, their women's studies departments quite openly talk about getting grants from the Ford and the Rockefeller Foundation. So these aren't really new trends here. I mean, if it wasn't for their support, I don't even think feminism would have made it into the 80s.
And yeah, that's the point that that Barrier guy makes, that it's more important to focus on the elites themselves, focusing too much on like the social justice warriors. Those people, basically, they're pawns, and they're not really worth all the energy discussing them. It's more important to focus on the plutocracy.
I definitely agree with him. I mean, the social justice warriors are basically, they're grunts. They are the shock troops of the cultural Marxist left and our elites mostly. They do their dirty work on the ground. Their job is to, spy on behalf of the elite. Spy on behalf of Big Brother. Determine who the who the dissidents are, and determine people who are the so-called Winston Smiths of our society, and then sort of root them out. And then destroy them, usually by attacking their livelihoods and their sources of income. So I don't really think it's important to actually focus specifically on those guys, but I do think it's more important to actually understand what our elites are doing and what they're up to, and get a better understanding of their initiatives. Because currently the system that's in place is one that cannot function without our cooperation. Universities, Hollywood, a lot of the degeneracy that's been pumped out that our elites have been manufacturing and then force feeding us over the last few decades, this cannot happen without a certain degree of cooperation from society, at least at this point. So that's, I think Barry Guy is quite right when he points this out, that we should be focusing on our elites. And I did make that point in my article as well, where when I spoke about resisting the elites, stay away from universities, stay out of debt.
So yeah, I
Throw
want
away
to
your
get into
TV,
that
that sort of thing.
article later in the show, but I want to look at this one, National Capitalism, a Third Alternative. And this one was posted on your blog and over at Alternative Right. Are you familiar with the
Familiar with him?
writer Alain de Benoist?
No, I don't know. I'm not familiar with them, no.
Okay, but he's actually critical of the concept of national capitalism, because the point he makes is that capitalists are not content with just making profits within a country, that capitalism inevitably leads to globalization because capitalists want to go beyond the national borders to increase their profits, and through things like mass immigration and free trade. You make the case for national capitalism. Do you believe that national capitalism is viable, or do you think that globalization is an inevitable result of capitalism?
At this point, I would have to agree that, you cannot turn back the clock, and globalization is really here to stay. And capitalism has its flaws, and I'm the first to admit that it does have its flaws. And in some ways, it is not a very sustainable system. But I do agree, but I do, but I will say that if capitalism is a system that, if capitalism is here to stay, then what capitalists should really do is focus their efforts at, focus their efforts at furthering the interests, the economic interests of their own countries. That's basically what national capitalism should do. Now, I understand what he's saying, and I can see this is the case in the West, which is very unfortunate. I mean, one of the reasons why mass immigration is such a big deal in the West is obviously because Western economies are at this point largely services-based economies, what you call tertiary sectors, and because they're services-dominated economies, and since services cannot really be exported. Well, I suppose some services can be exported, but for the most part, it's goods and services. It's goods that are mostly products, tangible products that are really exported, and they make up the bulk of international trade even today. So, if services cannot be exported, and if Western economies are largely services oriented, then the only way to keep their economy, to keep these economies afloat, is to simply keep importing immigrants who would eventually become consumers of these services. So, it's funny because in the old days, of course, when manufacturing was big in the 1800s and the early 19th century, in the 1900s, the colonialism was important, strategically. It was a strategically important activity because you had to go out there and capture markets and then, force them to buy your stuff. I mean, the U.S. has been doing this for decades. I mean, they've also sold a lot of agricultural output to Iraq, for example, when Saddam Hussein sabotaged Iraq's own agricultural industry, which is very similar to what Britain did to India with regards to textiles in the 1800s, 1850s, and onwards. But today, what we're doing, rather than going out and colonizing a country, what we're doing with mass immigration is actually quite literally importing consumers into our borders. Now this doesn't necessarily always have to be the case, because if you look at Japan, the Japanese and even the Koreans to some degree are actually quite patriotic, even their businesses. It's all about mindset, really. I mean, it depends on your values. I mean, to the Japanese, there's a saying, to be a good patriot, you need to be a good son. And
Yeah,
so.
Japan has a very strict immigration policy, and it's if you look at the country, it's extremely homogenous. I think it's like 99% Japanese and 1% Korean. So you're giving Japan an
It's true. They
example.
are, yeah, they are homogenous, but also they prefer to keep it that way. I mean, polls have shown that immigration is highly unpopular, amongst the Japanese. So they prefer to keep it that way, and they prefer to keep certain policies, in place because of overwhelming public support.
Does Japan have
Sorry,
a
go on.
strong social safety net?
They do have some social safety, but I'm not entirely aware of how their social safety net works. I do know that they've got something. I know there's virtually none in China, despite being a communist country. But as to Japan and their capitalist model, basically, there's no real model here. It's basically just Japanese businessmen who have a certain outlook. They have a certain mindset that if we're going to go into business, we should be benefiting Japan. We should be cooperating with one another and competing with the rest of the world. And that's what national capitalism does. National capitalism will eventually then enable a country to compete effectively with other countries. And in the case of Japan, of course, it's important because to them, if you cannot be a good patriot without being a good son. So a lot of businesses feel that they owe their loyalty to Japan first and foremost. And so a lot of companies, I think like Toyota, for example, I remember reading somewhere, they would source a lot of their parts locally. It would be more expensive, but that's what they would do. Whereas in the West, this is really not the case anymore. But again, Japan also has a very strong, I mean, Japanese culture, the Japanese people have a very strong racial identity. See, in the West, that no longer exists. So all that's left, of course, is the pursuit of profit. And that is it. That is all. I mean, I remember writing about this on the blog where I was working for a local company, and I was one of my assignments was to have these promotion items made. And I started looking for local suppliers, and I submitted it to my boss, and I said that, these are some of the local suppliers. And by local, I mean national, actually, in Canada, basically Canada-wide. So I found some suppliers in Vancouver, and I said that they've got the most competitive prices, per piece. And she said, not good enough. Start looking at China. So then I logged on to the Alibaba e-commerce portal, and I started looking through there, started looking at options in China. But you see, it never even occurred to me initially to start looking at China. I mean, to me, my idea was that, we should try to keep our money here in Canada. But that's not a priority that's shared by a lot of businesses here. To them, it's all about,
Well, a lot of it is the point you're making is that it's not just the economic system, it's a culture as well. People grow up in Japan with a sense of nationalism, and in this country, most of the elite has a totally internationalistic outlook. They just care about profits. Obviously, corporate CEOs in Japan are—I mean—they're capitalists. They're driven by profits, but there's still a culture there where you're expected to put your country first.
Exactly. National
And
capitalism is merely an attitude, because capitalism is not like Marxism, which comes with this worldview in place. I mean, there are certain underlying Western values upon which capitalism stands, but such as individualism. But for the most part, capitalism is merely an economic system. It's neutral. It's an economic system. It's basically a system where the factors of production, land, labor, capital, are in the hands of the private sector. That's all it is.
but
Nothing more, nothing less. That's all it is. Now, how you use this system depends on your culture. If you're like the Japanese or the Koreans, and you believe that, if these resources are in the hands of the private sector, and if the private sector is comprised of patriotic individuals, then businesses by default will, make it a priority to serve their own nations. First, they would try their hardest to serve their own countries, their own home countries. So they'd compete internationally. But the idea was to serve their own countries. That's just an outlook. Now, this has nothing to do with capitalism. This has more to do with culture. In the West, of course, as we were just discussing, since there's no real racial identity, much of that racial identity has been diluted through multiculturalism. This becomes much
Do you
harder.
think
All that's
the
left.
Japanese businessmen, do you think they are patriotic, or do you think it is more to do is the regulations put in by the government? And do you think if given the opportunity, they would behave in the manner of the American elites if they were allowed to?
Well, I'm thinking if they wanted to, they probably would have done these things. They probably would have found ways to lobby and pressure their governments, but they haven't. In the West, this is a very common occurrence. You have these, you've got elites that work with one another, and then they sort of lobby the government to provide them with, legal and sometimes even military cover to continue doing what they're doing. But if the Japanese could have done this, they probably would have. But I don't think they really do. I don't think they really want to. Their idea is to basically serve their own countries. There's a certain degree of patriotism in Japan that's really hard to comprehend in the West. There really is. It's a very strong sense that, Japan is, a great nation, and of course everyone needs to do their bit.
With the Western elites we have, do you think it's necessary to push for more like wealth confiscation and raising taxes on the rich as a way to deal with the problem?
I do think that there should be some regulations in place. I mean, I hate to sound like Ralph Nader here, but he was essentially correct when he pointed out that a lot of these corporations just don't give a crap at all. And so, there has to come a time where, governments have to step up on behalf of their people, the people who elected them into power to begin with, and then sort of, mandate certain regulations, to keep the capital within their countries. Because right now, I mean, you can just If you don't like paying taxes, you can just move the headquarters to somewhere else. And I think Halliburton moved their headquarters too. I think they moved them to the Middle East, I think to Dubai, as a matter of fact. But this is something that you can do.
A lot of corporations, like the island, I think it's the Cayman Islands, has this one building where all these corporations have their headquarters in this one small building in the Cayman Islands.
Oh yeah, and see, this is shameful though. I mean, also just look, just take a look at the ratio between workers and CEOs, that is in terms of wages and income, national incomes. Sorry, that is annual incomes. So in the US, CEOs make over, I think, 400 times more than the average worker, whereas in Japan,
Yeah,
the
I have the
ratio.
statistics up on, it's on the alternative right article. I'll link to it. In the United States, it's 475.
Oh
Mexico, it's
yeah.
47. Japan's has the lowest ratio to pay worker. It's
Now
11.
see, now
It's
of
11
course.
to
Now
1, and then Germany is 12 to 1. So my question is, how much regulation do they have to keep the pay in check? Like, what is the tax rate on the top income bracket?
in some countries, I don't think it's really all about, I don't think it's all about, I don't think it's really about taxes either though. And that's one of the points I wanted to come to. I mean, if you look at Canada, for example, Canadian elites would end up doing the same thing if they had the chance to. And in Canada, the tax rates are fairly high. If you're the wealthy end up paying about 45% in taxes, which is huge. But of course, there's ways around it though. What's ideal, and I suppose this is more of a not what is, but a what ought to be scenario, is where elites should have a sense of patriotism to begin with, so that you don't really need these regulations. I know I sound kind of confusion here, it's kind of how Confucianism is, there shouldn't really be these laws in place. People should simply do these things. In the case of
Maybe
Japan, I mean,
that's too idealistic. Maybe there needs to be, that's kind of assuming the best of human nature.
oh yeah, I suppose it is. It is a little idealistic. I don't deny. But see, in Japan, of course, 11 to 1 is probably the smallest ratio, And I'm fairly certain that, patriotism definitely has a lot to do with this. So it's fascinating stuff. I mean, Japan's business culture is quite interesting. It's also really quite high trust, which is somewhat unusual in Asia. But they're really quite high trust. They've got their whole Keiritsu network thing going. It's
So with the way
an
the
interesting way of doing business.
Keiritsu, the banks, the corporations actually have their own bank instead of having to borrow money from another bank. That's what it is. They pull their resources together and they run their own bank called the Keiritsu.
Yes, they do, and it's not just through banking, but there are times where suppliers and their customers, retailers and such, would sort of buy each other's shares. So the idea is that we all succeed or we all fail, we all rise together, we all fall together, and this is something. And again, like I said, forming these kinds of networks requires a very strong degree of racial awareness and racial consciousness, something which is almost impossible or even unthinkable in the West. But the Japanese have been able to pull it off, and it's a pretty interesting way of doing business, I think.
I'll give you an example. In places where the elites are, places that are very diverse, place like the Japanese elite, they live in Tokyo, so that's very homogenous, and they grew up with a different mindset. I think elites who grow up in diverse cities like LA, New York, and London grow up with a very parasitic mindset.
I would, yeah. I mean, it goes without saying that multiculturalism definitely has, a diluting effect on
Because they
national
grow up,
identity.
it's a low trust environment where they don't see people as part of their community. They see them as people to to screw over. They grow up with that mindset.
In some ways, yes. This multiculturalism, apart from having, some serious economic repercussions, mostly negative, it also has a more damaging effect on democracy as well. So I really the you know this is something Beria has spoken about as well. What's the cost of these programs? So there's an upkeep here, and that upkeep is now being paid for by the white taxpayer. But for how long? Well, multiculturalism and feminism and so on, I mean, a lot of these leftist programs have an upkeep. So
You make the
multiculturalism
point
has.
that the United Arab Emirates has one of the most generous welfare systems in the world, but it's only available to their own citizens. So you were, when you lived there, you were not able to partake in it.
Oh no, absolutely not. And there's no way I would become a citizen, or anyone could become a citizen living in the UAE. You just cannot. So to them, the UAE is not really a multicultural society. It's a diverse society, but it's not a multicultural society. Multiculturalism is a means to managing diversity. The other way is assimilation. Or then you have the UAE where the Dubai way, the Dubai method, which is basically creating this segregated class structure. So, but of course, that's not going to fly in the West. So in the West, typically it was assimilation or multiculturalism. And now, of course, our elites have pretty much thrown their resources behind multiculturalism.
Would you, living in Dubai, did you find that article by Matt Forney to be accurate? Were you shocked by it or not really?
No, not really. I've heard stories of their depravity. And the sheikhs are truly a very degenerate class. I mean, as that writer A. Gill pointed out, in his article in the Vanity Fair, which was actually banned in Dubai. Pretty funny article, actually. I enjoyed it. Quite accurate, though. But a lot of these Emiratis are born retired, and Emirati sheikhs they're born into luxury, and they don't really have to do anything. In the West, elites still bring up their young to be traditionally anyhow to become more cultured and so on, contribute to society. And the traditional idea is that elites are supposed to enrich society. They've got more leisure time, so they should spend that time pursuing higher culture such as art, philosophy, and then sort of contribute to the culture in which they were born into. This is not really the case in the Middle East. As a matter of fact, it's not really even the case in South Asia. But in the Middle East, these people have so much money, they have so much leisure time, and it's basically decadence they pursue. So it shows you the difference, another difference, between East and West.
What was your personal lifestyle like when you lived in Dubai? What was your social status?
Middle class mostly. We lived in an area which was a very sort of like a very Indian area, an Indian zone of the city. I mean, Dubai is a very segregated city, right? So,
So you
I
didn't
mean, I've
really, you
seen.
didn't personally associate with the oil sheikhs.
Oh, absolutely not. There's no way. No, absolutely not. I mean, I do know I had a cousin. I think he's still in the business. He's a millionaire many times over, and I know he has contacts among the sheikhs. But I have personally never had the opportunity to associate with any of them. So, no, not me. Dubai is a very segregated society, anyhow. I mean, I've seen the segregation throughout the 90s, but now it's not as ghettoized as it used to be during the 90s, where you had certain areas, certain ethnic enclaves, around the city. Like Dea was specifically for South Asians, Jumeirah was for Europeans, specifically the British, and so on and so forth.
So with you talk about a welfare state, so the point you made about United Arab Emirates, they have a it's a citizen's dividend for their own citizens. You say that a welfare state can only work in a homogeneous society.
Preferable, actually. It's preferable to work. It works in a homogeneous society. I mean, the best results are in a homogeneous society, largely. I mean, in multicultural societies, or in societies in the West where identity politics is the order of the day, you use welfare to keep certain groups, as dependents on the state. This is particularly the case in Europe, and even here, in North America. I mean, if you're waging war against the white majority, and you have, say, a lot of Mexicans or whatever who are coming in, they'll vote Democrat simply because the Democrats are probably more likely to give them handouts compared to some of the other parties, most likely the Republicans. But of course, the Republicans want them as well for cheap labor. But in a more homogeneous society, socialism tends, well, at least some social programs, targeted social programs, tend to work because there's high trust in these cultures. And so, in such a situation, I think the welfare state does a far better job, doing what it's supposed to do, in terms of egalitarian goals, as opposed to in a multicultural society.
You wrote this article called America's Tainted Democracy, and
Right.
this is about a South Asian businessman in the United States. There was this BBC documentary, and
Oh, it's just a news clipping from the BBC website, actually.
okay, so there's this Pakistani businessman who was he was lobbying the US government to give more foreign aid to Pakistan.
Right, and then of course you've got a very strong Indian lobby as well in place right now that's sort of emulating the tactics of the Jewish lobby. And I think the idea that I was trying to convey here, this article, is that multiculturalism is quite detrimental to the health of democracy. Diversity will also do that to you, for the most part. I would say that if you want to see what American democracy looks like in 30 years or 40 years, take a look at India's democracy today. In India, for example, you've got, it's a democracy, a manner of speaking, but it's one where there's no competition of ideologies. In the US, because, Western culture tends to be more universal, you have a competition of ideologies, where an ideology is in some ways a universal interpretation of reality. But in India, people will simply vote for whoever is a part of their own caste or their own religion. So as my favorite journalist, Indian journalist Akar Patel points out, there are no debates in Indian politics because there's no need for it. If you're simply going to vote for your own man, for somebody from your own caste or someone from someone along ethnic lines or linguistic lines, then there's no need for debate. You debate, the whole idea behind debating is that you debate universal principles, principles that can apply universally. So I do think that in time, this is what's going to happen. You have a bunch of, as America becomes more and more diverse, the health of American democracy begins to somewhat deteriorate, because democracy does not really check tribalism. As a matter of fact, democracy enables tribalism, and we see this very clearly in South Asia and even in the Middle East. I mean, in the Middle East, I remember you had these, you've got these strong. You had these strongman dictatorship rules, right? Rulers like, Mubarak in Egypt, or, you had Saddam Hussein, obviously. And I've spoken to a lot of Christians, over the years, and a lot of them said that, even though these people were dictators, they still felt safe living, within these dictatorships because their interests were protected by these dictators. Iraqi Christians especially were fond of Saddam because he actually kept them safe. Now, if Iraq were a majority, things, I mean, if, I'm sorry, if Iraq were a democracy, then, a lot of these, there would be a lot of anti-Christian sentiment that would become, politically viable. So in some ways, I do think that democracy actually enables tribalism, and in certain societies, like in the non-Western world, there's a very fine line that separates democracy from mob rule. So in India as well, for example, one of the reasons why Modi was able to win is because he basically rode the anti-Muslim consensus. And while people talk about how he's a great economist and so on and so forth, there's no real evidence that he is a great economist. Gujarat was prosperous before he came to power, and it's going to be prosperous long after he retires. So it's this, and I think this is what's going to happen in the US as well. As the US becomes more diverse, you'll have a bunch of ethnic groups competing and fighting amongst themselves to consolidate their own power and their own, share of the economy. And this is
Do
obviously
you
going to
think
be this,
this whole
and this is
sort
all.
of right now there's this concept of kind of this rainbow coalition? Do you think that will break up and it'll just be like every tribe for itself?
Well, that depends. I think Bay Area guy has the right idea here. He mentions that if the U.S. becomes economically impoverished, as the U.S. economy continues to deteriorate, what will happen is there won't be a lot of funding for a lot of these liberal programs, and that's when the Rainbow Coalition will break apart. And I think he's right there. There's an upkeep here, right? There's an upkeep here, that keeps these people together for now. But once resources begin to dry up, what then? Feminism has tremendous upkeep. And so I do think that, of course, as the US becomes poorer economically, the liberal coalition, this rainbow coalition, might fall apart. But at this point in time, they're a useful political tool.
What role do you see South Asians playing in the future of the United States?
I honestly do believe that they're poised to become the next generation of elites in the U.S. because they're highly selected, they're highly intelligent, and they're quite affluent, and they're able to somewhat outcompete some of the other ethnic groups in the U.S. and not by a narrow margin, by a huge margin. I believe that the second most affluent group, at least Indians are the second most affluent group in the U.S. I think second just after the Jews. So
Do you think
they
they could
very
surpass
easily.
them at some point?
I highly doubt that, but they will have a seat at the table, and that's what they want. I mean, if you've seen that video, which I posted on the website, that's exactly what that representative of the one of the Indian lobbies had said very quite explicitly. We want a seat at the table. They're not able to dominate, obviously, and they never will be for various reasons, for some very obvious reasons. But I think what they want is they want a seat at the table, and I think in this new multicultural democracy, that's what's going to happen. Every ethnicity will want a seat at the table, and there'll be a considerable bit of competition. Now, some I think will be worse off than others. For example, African Americans will be much worse off in this new America because these new Asian elites, whether they're Koreans or Indians, they're not really going to care much about the interests of African Americans. They don't really suffer from any form of guilt. And Mexicans will obviously be worse off as well.
Do you think the South Carolina shooter was idiotic when he said Black Americans are taking over the country?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I definitely think so. There's no way they can do that. They're quite disadvantaged economically, and they pose no real threat. They can be used as a tool, of course, by Democrats and mostly our elites, but I don't think they pose a major threat in any way. I do think that, as I pointed out, I do think that East Asians and South Asians are poised to, have a much better chance of getting their seat at the table, so to speak.
Would you say South Asians more so than East Asians?
At this point, I would say so, yes. I do think East Asians have a very strong chance too, actually. They've got very similar values. And but of course, let's not forget though.
What are the biggest differences between South Asians and East Asians?
Well, in terms of their worldviews, they're obviously very different, right? I mean, the South Asian worldview, regardless of religion, is largely Hindu, whereas the East Asian worldview is mostly Confucian. But in the United States, they have a certain advantage over a lot of the other ethnicities, and that is they've got a very strong degree of racial awareness and racial consciousness, which they use. I mean, just look at the way, I mean, in that video, you should have seen the way the two of them were discussing, the interests of their communities. It requires a tremendous degree of racial awareness and racial consciousness to be able to pursue those goals in the same way, with the same dedication, that these people were doing, these people were going about. There was no regard for the good of the whole or the good of the United States in general. All this fellow was concerned about, the Pakistani guy was concerned about, was getting aid to Pakistan. And of course, this is going to be at the expense of the U.S. taxpayer. Now, if he's an American citizen, it's the U.S. taxpayer that should be his priority, right? Not really the affairs of Pakistan. But that's not really the case here. So, like I said, it requires a great deal of racial consciousness to do this. And I think South Asians, especially Indians, and even the East Asians have that, which gives them that advantage.
So with this article on national capitalism, what are some fundamental policies of national capitalism? You say that you say that resources need to be from domestic sources, there needs to be protectionism. Can you just go over a list of the fundamental policies that would be needed to have national capitalism? I think before we talked more about the culture, but what are actual public policies that would be necessary?
I think protectionism is important. Protectionism is very important, and I think there should be some sort of regulation on outsourcing. Outsourcing is probably one of the worst things, one of the worst things that could have happened to the U.S. in the 20, and even to North America in general in during the 20th century. Outsourcing is something that needs to be regulated. I mean, national, with regards to protectionism, I know a lot of Western elites, neoliberals in particular, tend to hate and bash protectionism considerably. But protectionism has its advantages. You know, I mean, it's protectionism has served India quite well. I mean, it's true that India's economy grew quite slowly from the 40s to the 80s, but they were able to build up their domestic industries. They were able to build, you know, they were able to create their own soft drinks industries and car industry, automotive industries and so on. So protectionism is, of course, very important. And, of course, neoliberals hate it because it, you know, it bars them access to foreign markets. Outsourcing is another big deal. You know, outsourcing, of course, hurts the economy in many ways, many obvious ways. And another focus of national capitalism should be to bring back manufacturing. Manufacturing is very important because manufacturing, of course, accumulates capital in a way that services cannot. Like I pointed out before, earlier in our conversation, you cannot really export a service. Well, you can export some services, of course. I mean, like, let's say programming, computer software and stuff like that. I mean, you can export some services, yes. But if you study statistics currently, you know, it's, you know, the global economy, that is in terms of international trade, is still dominated by the movement of goods, actual physical, tangible products, goods. So there should be an emphasis in bringing back manufacturing. Manufacturing is key because it creates a certain skill set in the population. And of course, it also acts as a barrier against cultural Marxism as well. I pointed that out as well. That's also somewhat of an added bonus. You know,
do you think that banking should be a public utility?
I haven't really given banking too much thought, to be honest with you. I do know that our current banking system is somewhat broken. But whether this should be public, that's worth thinking about. I haven't really thought about banking a whole lot, no. I was focused more on protectionism and manufacturing, mostly.
But isn't, you know, Donald Trump actually proposed putting a tax on outsourcing? Do you hear about that?
That's not a bad idea. No, I wasn't aware of it, but I was aware of him trying to bring back manufacturing to the U.S. That's something I'd heard of. And taxing companies that outsource is actually a pretty good idea, and I think it's a very good idea, in fact, because if you have, let's say you're a company that's in business, let's say you trade in, say, T-shirts, for example, or any other item, right? Now, if you import some of these products from China or whatever, you're able to make more money than someone who's sourcing these products locally, obviously. And as you accumulate, and as your profits dwarf theirs, you know, you can then run them out of business. So this sort of thing works if everyone is into it, you know. So it's sort of like protectionism in some ways, you know. If you tax these companies that actually outsource, or, you know, buy, you know, import products from abroad, and they could very easily source them here locally, then you make their businesses somewhat uncompetitive as well. And that kind of levels the playing field, I think. So I think Trump has the right idea in some ways by, you know, taxing these companies that outsource. And I'd go so far as to even taxing companies that try to import things from abroad, which is, of course, just protectionism, you know, increasing import duties and such. So I think, these things are viable. So this will force the economy to become somewhat more efficient, you know, manufacture what you need and then import only things that are not available to you locally. This is actually how India was able to weather the global recession of 2008, because much of what India manufactures and produces is consumed domestically. You know, there's China and some of these other countries, especially Singapore, you know, more export-dominated economies were in trouble. But of course, that's another matter altogether. But I do think that, yes, you know, there should be a strong emphasis on preventing outsourcing. It's quite the bane of modern capitalism, in my view.
So you have this article, Resisting Our Cultural Marxist Elites, A Few Strategies to Consider. And first of all,
right,
I want to make the point that I think the terminology cultural Marxist elites could be could kind of sound oxymoronic. I think
I beg your
Barry
pardon?
Guy is actually, I think Barry Guy has made this point to sort of avoid using like the buzzword cultural Marxist because I think it's confusing to people because it's very different than economic Marxism. When people hear Marxism, they think about redistribution of wealth. So I agree with the points you make in this article, but I think the terminology cultural Marxism could be confusing to people. Do you agree with that point?
I do think that it could be confusing, yes, but it's a term that so accurately describes, the modern left. Now, I've heard various criticisms of the term cultural Marxism. First and foremost is that, the Frankfurt School intellectuals like Theodor Adorno and some of the others never really used that phrase themselves. They didn't. They saw themselves as Marxists, and the idea here was that to them, it was American culture, Western culture, traditional culture that's the greatest barrier, that prevents, the rise of the, revolution. And so the culture has to be taken down, torn down. And that's basically the premise of cultural Marxism right there. So now I understand they never use the phrase directly, and a lot of opponents, a lot of leftists have made this argument saying that, well, they never use this phrase, and so it's basically just this, bogus boogeyman thing that alternative right wingers use to create some sort of straw man. But I don't necessarily agree with this, though. Just because the term was never used by Theodor Adorno does not necessarily mean the term lacks legitimacy. I mean, consider the fact that up until the 2nd century AD, the term Christian was never really used. But did that mean that Christianity over the last 2 centuries did not exist? Of course it existed. But the term Christian itself came to be used much later on, somewhere around the 2nd century, probably after Tertullian or so. But that's basically my take on it. I mean, I understand what Barry Guy is saying, but I don't necessarily agree, though. I think it's a term that quite accurately describes what's become of the left, identity politics, where you've got the bourgeoisie happen to be the white majority, and the new proletariat were basically these protected ethnic groups. So it's the same idea of class struggle. It's just been reconfigured in some ways, and sort of cast into a new mold here.
I think what's confusing is that it's very different than economic Marxism.
Not particularly, actually. If you think about it, it's the same idea. I mean, as I pointed out, you're the bourgeoisie are basically just, the white elites. Not just the white elites, actually, more like, traditional Western culture. And you've got this traditional Western culture, which is seen as being inherently oppressive, and that was basically the idea behind Theodor Adorno's critical theory, So the idea that traditional Western culture is, in some ways, the tool of the bourgeoisie, and it oppresses various groups. And so, these groups need to somehow, the interests of these groups are quite separate from the interests of traditional Western culture, the white majority, and so on. So, in some ways, of course, for the revolution to take place, you need to tear down Western culture in the same way as in traditional economic Marxism. The only way the proletariat can win is if private property and wealth are abolished. So here, in this case, it's traditional Western culture that's been marked for demolition. So if you think about it, it's not all that different. The focus, it's still Marxism. It's just simply Marxism applied to culture. In the same way as feminism is basically Marxism applied to gender. So it still is Marxism in my view. It shouldn't really confuse people, but I can see how it might confuse some. Yes.
You're talking about the oligarchy and defunding the elites. So the points you make are to boycott the media, to stay out of debt, and to boycott universities.
As I pointed out a little earlier in our conversation, currently the system is such that it requires a certain degree of cooperation from us to thrive and sustain itself, And what we can do is we can choose not to cooperate, not to participate, and we can thereby encumber the system. Now we know that modern universities are the hotbeds of cultural Marxism, But by avoiding universities, we can deprive our elites, of this tool. So, I mean, take a look at the economy, and the economy also plays a role here. I mean, if you look at Saskatchewan's economy here, for example, it's not as services dominated as the economies of Ontario, for example. There still is a very strong service sector here, no doubt. But there's also a lot of natural resources, a lot of manufacturing, and when you compare this to, say, Montreal or to Ontario, which are mostly services based, and that's one of the reasons why there's somewhat of a there's not cultural Marxism has not reached the same level as it has in Ontario, because if you have an economy that produces welders, plumbers, fabricators, and so on, it's going to necessarily produce fewer feminists and leftist majors and so on. And it's true. I mean, in my article, if you well, it's not this article. There's another article I've written before this. If you had, I mean, where I went on, I logged on to the University of Saskatchewan's website, and I looked at their graduates, their numbers, and there was about 300 and something graduates that year in computer studies, and only 19 in women's studies. So it's really quite interesting how the economy plays that role as well. But we can actually do this. There are ways we can resist the system by simply not cooperating. There's no way we can actually go and restructure the system. That's not going to happen. But we can encumber the system, and that's the point I was trying to make. Turn off your TV. Don't go to movies. I mean, people. There's so many on the alternative right that complain about Hollywood degeneracy and all of that. But there's a simple solution. Just don't go to the movies. Don't throw away your TV. So there's a lot of things that we can do to encumber the system. If we hit our elites where it hurts in the pocketbooks, then that'll actually help in the long run.
I think the key point to make is, I mentioned this earlier, that the important thing to focus on is the oligarchy itself. A lot of this other stuff, like the social justice warriors and a lot of the culture is very important, but that's also the root cause where the real power structure is the financial oligarchy.
Oh, absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt there, though. Because right now, we still have this funny view that our elites represent our interests. But this is not really the case. I mean, I know there's some people that are somewhat cynical regarding corruption and nepotism, amongst those in the upper echelons of society, and that's understandable. But very few people actually understand or are aware of the fact that our elites are actually working or are actually hostile, to the interests of their nations. They're hostile to the interests of, white people who are the majority here and the founding stock of these nations. They don't seem to understand that these elites, because when they look at these elites, they seem to think that, oh, well, we're white and they're white. But they don't seem to understand that these elites are actually they're actually hostile to the interests of the white majority. They're working against them, actively working against them in ways that non-Western elites do not. I mean, non-Western elites might be corrupt, but they still do look out for their people to some degree, with the exception of India, of course. But even in the Middle East, for example, I mean, if you look at some of these, I mean, we were talking about their social welfare programs that are targeted directly to their own citizens, who are like 20% of the population. So they're a
But you were
privileged
making the
minority.
point that in the United Arab Emirates, what they do is they actually will cut off benefits to political dissidents. But for the most part, who are the political dissidents? Are they people who want to make the country more Islamic, or are they mostly people who want more freedom?
Well, the United Arab Emirates and, Qatar, Dubai, Qatar and Kuwait, and with the exception of Saudi Arabia, some of these countries have a somewhat love-hate relationship with the Wahhabis. On one hand, on one hand, most Emiratis actually subscribe to a Wahhabi interpretation of Islam, but on the other hand, they don't want Wahhabis to come to power because a lot of their economy still depends on foreign investment, tourism, and all that, right? So they've got a somewhat of a love-hate relationship with Wahhabis. Secretly, they do agree with them. They do share certain elements of their worldview. I mean, they do have certain elements of their worldview in common, but they also kind of want to keep them at arm's length. But on the other hand, you also have other dissidents that are, somewhat against the authoritarian nature of the United Arab Emirates. They want the system to be more transparent. They're not actually calling for dismantling the monarchy, but what they are really calling for, at least from what I've learned while I was living there, is that they're actually calling for greater transparency. Where's the money coming from? Where's the money going? The system should be somewhat more democratic We're not trying to replace Sheikh Mohammed and his family. We're not trying to replace the Khalifas. But what we're trying to do here, at least from their point of view, is make the system more transparent, so that Emiratis can, participate within, within certain, within certain policies that determine their own interests. But as far as the elites themselves are concerned, to go back to a previous point, yes, they actually do look out for their people. You have these generous welfare programs and such, but there's this confusion relationship almost, if I can even use a term, with regards to the Middle East, where if the elites are benevolent, then they expect complete obedience from, the subjects that they're ruling. And if there are any dissidents, it's seen as a breach of social contract. The elites are obviously being generous, so why are you complaining? Why are you rebelling? What's your problem? That's their attitude. At least that's the impression I get. So in Dubai, that seems to be really largely the case. We're being benevolent to you, and you should reciprocate with obedience. But there genuinely is a certain degree of concern that elites have for their people. And there's I mean, Dubai's welfare program is just ridiculous. In just how generous it is. It's too generous, in fact, of course. I mean, it's created a culture where people have become too lazy to work, especially Emiratis. But that's about to change, and it has been changing over the last 5 or 6 years because the global recession kind of left Dubai broke. So there's really not a whole lot of money to give out now in these socialist programs. So people are forced to work, and there's some interesting changes going on in the Middle East at this point. So we are out of time. I would like to thank Dota for being on the show. Check out his website, Occident Invicta.
Thanks very much for having me, Robert. Appreciate it.
Thanks again. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.